Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Tallapoosa, Glen.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey. My, you still are exaggerating after, what, 76 shows I think we've done, but thank you for getting us on tonight. And again, our phone number's up on the switchboard, which is good. A couple of weeks ago, we were confused when it didn't show up, but we were still broadcasting live. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen, and to the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm your host, Keith Haley, and we want to thank Johnny Cash for that fleeting trip he takes us across the United States. If we heard the whole song, it would be to more than 90 cities and states in the United States. And we're told, I've never seen him do it, but people have commented that he sings that song from memory. What a memory feat that is. Emily, Mike, good to see you in the booth tonight. Mike, I understand you got a little story for us tonight about some Robert Justice. I'm looking forward to hearing that one also. Folks, the purpose of our show is what it is every week. It's discussing news, issues, events, and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of the field of criminal justice. And we try to convey some of that humor each night of the show. And tonight we have a couple stories that are sort of interesting. Some of these things come out humorous when they're not supposed to be, but that's the nature of criminal justice. And we dedicate this show to these tireless police, court, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals who protect us throughout the United States and indeed throughout the world. I mentioned last week that one of the things we're going to do, we're going to be taking 25 or 30 of these shows out of the last 76 or 77 that we've done and gather them together and create an audio book. I think we're going to use the Audacity software, which is fine software if you don't know about that. And it's free and it's open source. And we're going to compile this book and call it something like Criminal Justice Heroes, Heroines and Heroes, or Heroes and Heroines, something like that. But it'll be some of these star performers, as it has been with every guest who's been on the show over the weeks and months and years that we've done the show. And each one of them will be a chapter of the book. And what this will accomplish is that people can get this CD, or perhaps they can pick it up off the net. Somehow they'd be able to use this in classes, but it would just be very interesting reading to hear people talk about experts in investigative hypnosis or the railroad police chief or the marshal, a marshal in the United States. So on and on and on. I'm doing short shrift to injustice some of the other people, but You can go to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumbo Justice site, and you can see all the folks that we've had on there, and it's an incredible lot. And I don't think we're going to get to that this week. I have it posted on the billing that we would also talk about the paper I delivered at the Academy of Criminal Justice Sciences meeting last week, last Thursday, as a matter of fact. It was an analysis of our shows and breakdown by categories and topics and that type of thing. But we're going to be caught up tonight with this District of Columbia gun case. And this is what Blog Talk Radio was made for, ladies and gentlemen. Guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to take you right into the United States Supreme Court room this past Tuesday, and you're going to hear a good portion of the arguments in the case of the District of Columbia versus Hauer. And, of course, that's the D.C. handgun ban case. The District of Columbia does not permit you to have a handgun at all inside the city limits. You cannot own, possess, carry one, and neither can you have a firearm in your home that is assembled. I know what you're saying, Mike. In fact, you're going to hear a very funny line. I'm going to play that one for sure. One time in this whole hour and a half, just about the United States Supreme Court cracks up over one of the justices' comments, and I'll keep that a secret until we hear it tonight. But what we tried to do in the show, of course, is look inside the practice of criminal justice, and tonight will be a good example of that. Blog Talk Radio is a leading-edge technology and medium to allow you, a single person, an Interscoop, or any type of organization, to broadcast worldwide and streaming audio to an unlimited number of listeners, and it costs absolutely free, and you can do 14, 15, 16, who knows how many hours a week that you're permitted to do now. Did you catch the price? Yes, it's free. And I'm astounded sometimes. In the group that I made the presentation to last week, they had never heard of the Blog Talk Radio Network, where 66,000 shows plus are now archived there since it started in the summer of 2006. We started early in the fall, well, October of 2006, and got on it pretty early. And if you look on that site now, you'll see names and faces, celebrities, stars, athletes, all sorts of people appearing on BTR, Blog Talk Radio Network, that you will have all heard of. Then there's these esoteric little shows like ours, and as I said, I don't think it was Harold my Goldfish, but somebody said once that we're the NPR of criminal justice, and we will accept that as a compliment. So anyway, you get your own show. If you don't like this one, it's possible and it won't cost you a darn thing, and you can be signed up literally in probably about 8 or 9 minutes and ready to broadcast. But as I said, their show tonight is the Washington, D.C. gun case. It's Washington, D.C. Versus Heller, and we'll give you a few details of that case to sort of set you up in the beginning. We're going to be playing some sound clips, and one of the sound clips will be from NPR, and Nina Totenberg, who's the legal reporter for NPR, does a fine job over the years. She's been there a long time, and she's been the Supreme Court reporter. She'll sort of set up the case for us. I think she shades some of the features of the case just a little, but perhaps I can comment on that later on. And I hope you enjoyed last week, Michael Lewis, Professor Michael Lewis, and his marvelous topic that he's writing a dissertation on, police services, the police, and the homeless. And he's been on, I had him on for repeat performance because he had gone twice to the city of Dallas over a period of a year when they had been taking a census of the homeless. And a lot of the big cities that are progressive and trying to do something about that problem, in fact, take a census on a fairly regular basis. So what you do as a listener, of course, is just stay tuned if you're listening on your phone, or you can listen on Windows Media Player by going to the BTR site and clicking on the Jumbo Justice Radio Show. It will pop right up there with tonight's show, and all you have to do is click on the arrow, and you're all set to listen to the show. If you feel like calling in during our news segment tonight, or any part, actually, what we're going to do is allow you to do that. And we can hold 5 calls at one time. I know what you're saying, Audrey. Yes, it is true. I am having fire ant coffee. Audrey is surprised that when I have a little bit of a cold, I have coffee and I put Louisiana hot sauce in it. She says, what? I says, well, you never have to worry about your coffee getting cold. But it does sort of break up some of that stuff that clogs us up when you get a cold or serious sinus types of problems. I know people will say that's crazy until you've tried it, and then I think you'll probably be addicted to it. So anyway, we can hold five calls at one time, and people can listen to the calls, to the show all at once, and we can all talk to each other. And again, that's a marvelous feature of Blog Talk Radio. I guess it does cost you the price of a cell phone call or landline phone call, but still, that's a pretty good deal. Well, Audrey, all set with a blonde joke tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, we always start off with a blonde joke. Audrey England is from England, as a matter of fact. She is a blonde, and she's been a collector of blonde jokes since childhood. She has drawers and trunks full of blonde jokes, and she's pulled one out for us tonight. And you said this is a real short one? Okay, let's hear what it is. Yes? What joke? You found it, okay.
There is not doubt in my mind, Professor Haley, that this is the quickest blonde joke we have ever had on the radio show. Here it is. It is about two blondes on a vacation trip. Two blondes had driven across the country to see Disney World in Florida. As they approached it and got onto the final stretch of highway, they saw a sign saying Disney World left. After thinking for a minute, the driver blonde said, "Oh well," and started driving back home.
Well, thank you for that one, Audrey. I guess sometimes you can be too literal in your interpretation of road signs. That makes me think of something. You know, as you travel around the country over the years and you've been in some states, and you think there's sort of a universality about these road signs, and there's really not. Sometimes some of them are rather confusing. I remember coming into one of those circular intersections in Texas once, somewhere south of West Texas or north of Waco or somewhere, and there must have been like 13 streets coming into one like intersection, and it's like, now what do I do? But somehow I survived that. Ladies and gentlemen, particularly tonight, we like to support the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence and their attempt to get firearms off the street. And they have a public service announcement that they make fairly regularly in radio, I suppose, television, wherever, and we like to support that tonight. It's the High Coalition Against Firearms. What they're doing is they're playing this public service clip in order that gangbangers, street muggers, convenience store robbers, etc., will hear this and then go turn in their firearms. So let's listen up and hope that the right people hear this tonight.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, thank you very much, Coalition. And again, I hope you get a lot of subscribers, folks that pay attention to that ad and go turn in their firearms. Ladies and gentlemen, as we move to our news section tonight, let me comment on this first one, which is kind of an odd little thing. You know, you try various things, I'm told. I can recall as a police officer that when you stop people for some type of traffic violation, they have some of the strangest excuses. You've heard the one about the bumblebee on my seat, and it made me, you know, push my foot down on the accelerator, and I sped away, or I missed the stop sign, on and on and on. There's a litany of these kinds of things, but here's a first I've never heard concerning illegal cell phone use. This has to do with a German truck driver who escaped a charge for driving while using a mobile phone after he claimed he was using the phone is an ear warmer. That's right. A court in Ham accepted Walter Klein's claims that he had been using the phone, which was warm after being recharged, to warm his ears. It means he had not broken the law, which says drivers can only make phone calls with a hands-free set. Klein, 43, told the court, he says, "I had an earache, and it was being made worse because the cab had not heated up, yet it takes a while on a great big rig like I was driving. Says, so I grabbed the phone that had been on charge and put it up to my ear, and that is when I was stopped by the police." You know what? The court accepted his claim. He produced an itemized telephone bill proving that he had never used his telephone inside the truck, and particularly at the time he was stopped. So more power to him. What an interesting story. I don't think that warmer lasts probably too long, but I guess you could recharge it or leave it in the charger. That would be one thing. Story number two. Mike, you've got one kind of interesting. I would call this Robert Justice. There's only one thing left out in the end. They actually didn't catch him yet. But go ahead and let us know what this one's about, Mike. You all set with that thing?
Professor Haley, these robbers were reduced to tears. A pair of bank robbers burst into tears and collapsed choking in Poland after they tried to use pepper spray on a cashier in front of an air conditioning unit. The wind blew the spray back over the pair, who staggered from the bank in the southwestern city of Wrocław empty-handed. A local police spokesman said they told the cashier to open the till and then tried to put her out of action to grab the cash, but the pepper sprayed back in their faces because of the blast of warm air from the heater. They only managed to escape because they had to pal outside in a getaway car. Security cameras showed the crooks were wearing woolly black balaclavas, although Polish media speculated that if they strike again, they might well have switched to gas masks. Police are still looking for the crooks.
Good idea. I'll bet they thought that pepper spray was going to be a real debilitating thing, and they got in the path of an air conditioner current. That's a hoot. That's good. The only better thing could have happened is the cops and the security guard came in the front door and captured them. But I guess you got to be careful. You got to plan these things. You have to stake out your environment if you're going to be a successful criminal. So this next news story, I think I'm going to make it our last for tonight, is one that we're going to pay tribute to these folks in the Department of Homeland Security. Once in a while when we cover this illegal immigration debate in the United States, and we've done that, I guess, maybe five or six times, had some real experts on in that area. Dr. Charlie Williams was one of those who we had on for 2 weeks. But this is a real interesting story. Have you heard? As of an article published on March 17, the United States boosts its deportation of illegals. In the year 2006, we deported 186,000 illegal immigrants in the United States. Last year, because of a strict policy of arresting, prosecuting, and jailing illegal immigrants, they deported a record number, and that number was 280,000. So they're up almost 100,000 over the previous year, and that's absolutely outstanding, I think. It was the largest number of illegals ever removed from the country in a single year. And they say this is attributable to what veteran law enforcement authorities said is a revised apprehension process, adding that the department no longer is targeting only criminal illegals for removal. Does everybody get what that means? That means you had to be illegal and commit some type of crime, but seeks eventually to apprehend, charge, and deport all those who cross illegally into the United States. I will reiterate, cross illegally into the United States. They finally recognize that that is a crime. They've been passing that up for years. To that end, it says Homeland Security has initiated something called Operation Streamline along the same sectors of the U.S. border, which brings illegal immigrants into the U.S. criminal justice system, where they are prosecuted either for a misdemeanor on their first offense or for a felony if they've been caught before. What a great idea. I think folks have been suggesting this to them, including me, for quite a few years, that we ought to pay attention to the law that's broken as they cross the border, and now they're going to do that. Mr. Chertoff, he said between October and December, the Justice Department prosecuted 1,200 cases under the new program, and isn't that fascinating? 1,200 cases under the new program, and as a consequence, apprehension rates dropped nearly 70% in those particular areas on the U.S.-Mexico border. Isn't that something? Their target areas, apprehensions dropped 70%. What was the name of that group that showed them how to do that? I think that was U.S. Minutemen, and of course, we did a show, several shows about the U.S. Minutemen. And if you go to Conservative Justice Digest on the Internet, just Google that, You can get our research story there about that subject. It says, when people who cross the border illegally are brought to face the reality that they're committing a crime, even if it is just a misdemeanor, that has a huge impact on their willingness to try again and on the willingness of others to break the law coming across the border. This is Mr. Chertoff. That was a quote. And I think it took him a while to catch on to that, but they finally do it. I'm not going to beat this story to death. There's about three pages of it giving you some of the details. But, you know, out of that 280,523, that was the actual figure, that were deported in 2007, they came from 195 countries. Is that surprising to anyone? 195 countries. Says through February of fiscal 2008, the agencies had removed 94,237. So they're on a, I think, on a banner year if they keep working at that level. So very interesting idea. The notices are referred to by the U.S. Border Patrol as notices to appear. That's the way they used to do it, where they would, you'd get caught and then you'd be released, catch and release, and then you're supposed to come back for a court date, and only 13% of those people, duh, as they say, ever showed up. So now we're doing something different. Now, the downside of this is it takes more resources, it takes more jail and detention space, which they say we don't have. I think they could slip up the road there to Phoenix and talk to Sheriff Joe Arpaia up in Maricopa County. And I think he might have some ideas how you could save a little money on that detention space, right? I think it's called squad tents, where they could be living in that for a while, particularly down there in these warmer climates. So anyway, the Marshal Service says we don't have detention space, and they're also strapped for agents. But they have spent $22 million to hire additional prosecutors, support staff, and some U.S. Marshals who actually do the reporting. They're also seeking another $100 million for Southwest Border Enforcement Initiative. I guess that's a special program. You got to have a name. You have to have a name for it. But in fiscal 2007, ICE initiated formal removal proceedings on 164,000 illegal immigrants serving prison terms for crimes that they had committed in the United States. Can you believe that number? I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? 164,000 that they asked for indictments on. That is our removal proceedings. That's absolutely fascinating. But we congratulate the people in the ICE business, Immigration, Customs Enforcement, and all the others that are assisting in that fine effort to restore the nation's borders. I don't think you can have a nation unless you have secure borders, and I'm certainly not alone on that. All right, let's go ahead and switch to the D.C. gun case. One of the things I wanted to mention tonight, if you haven't ever had a chance to do it, is on OEA.com, OEA.com, it's O-Y-E-Z .com, you can actually hear, and OEA.com slash cases, you can actually hear the audio proceedings of the United States Supreme Court. You can hear the arguments when the cases are initially presented to the court. And that's what we're referring to tonight. This has actually been on the Internet. I started listening to that way back, probably the mid-1990s, maybe 12 or 13 years ago. But I still find people that don't know about it. And OEA.com just keeps getting better. One of the things that it's actually doing now, let me give you something here. Oh, did I say .com? Okay, Mike, I got it. It's OEA.org, .org, O-Y-E-Z.org. And what they're doing now on that site, when you click on the case, like our case tonight, it will actually have the picture of the first person that's speaking. You will hear the audio, and as they speak, the actual transcript scrolls right down next to their picture where you can follow along word for word with the audio recording. And then below that is the whole transcript existing by itself of the conversations of all the people, and it appears like a play, of course. If Justice Thomas is speaking, then it'll say Justice Thomas: and you can get off. But it's a wonderful a wonderful site if you haven't had a chance to do it. What I'm going to do tonight is start off with Nina Totenberg, if she's going to sort of set up the case for us, and then I'll have a couple comments about that before we actually listen to the Supreme Court proceeding on this Tuesday's case that was the D.C., Washington, D.C. versus Heller. Here we go.
The NPR shop invites you to tune up your CD collection. CDs from Car Talk and other NPR programs are available at npr.org/shop.
For the first time in nearly 70 years, the Supreme Court is entering the debate over the Second Amendment right to bear arms. At issue is Washington, D.C.'s ban on handguns, which is considered the nation's strictest gun control law. It is strict, but a court ruling that strikes down that handgun ban could imperil other less restrictive laws across the country, laws that ban machine guns, say, or assault weapons. Today's case has aroused huge interest among citizens and politicians alike, and it has divided even the president and vice president. Here's NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg.
The Second Amendment to the Constitution reads, "A well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed." For most of the last century, the courts have interpreted the amendment to mean that the right to bear arms is a collective right, a right associated with military service, not a personal right. But for many, the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms means the individual right to own and use a gun, if necessary, as a weapon against invaders, or even the government, a scenario embodied in this scene from the movie Men in Black, when a farmer refuses to surrender his gun.
"You can have my gun when you pry it from my cold, dead fingers."
To some, the right to bear arms is not quite that all-encompassing, but it's still an individual right.
"What I want is simply to be able to own a handgun in my house, in the confines of the wall of my house. Nothing else."
Shelley Parker is one of six individuals who initially challenged the D.C. handgun ban. An emergency room nurse turned computer software designer, she found herself the target of death threats from a local drug dealer after she organized homeowners to report drug activity in her neighborhood. Her gun awakening, as it were, came one night when a 7-foot, 2-inch tall drug dealer, who lived with his mother on the block, tried to break into her house and threatened to kill her. She chased him away by setting off the alarm. And when the police came,
the officer turned to me, just as plain as day, and said, "Get a gun."
Handguns, however, are illegal in the District of Columbia, so Shelley Parker joined a lawsuit organized by two local lawyers to challenge the ban. The district defends this law, arguing that handguns are responsible for 81% of the city's murders and most of the city's armed assaults, not to mention the danger handguns pose to children and to police called into domestic violence situations. The district contends that its residents are free to have other firearms at home for self-protection as long as they are kept trigger-locked or unassembled. A federal appeals court rejected that reading of the law and became the first federal court in modern times to invalidate a gun regulation as an unconstitutional restriction on the right to keep and bear arms. The district appeals to the Supreme Court, and today the justices hear arguments in the case. At the heart of the debate is what the Founding Fathers meant in enacting the Second Amendment. The district, pointing to the opening words of the amendment, "a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state," argues that the whole purpose of the amendment was to ensure that the new states would be able to maintain their militias without interference from the federal government. Representing the city of Washington today, former Solicitor General Walter Dellinger will tell the justices that in 1791 there was no reason to worry about Congress regulating the private possession of guns, that the dictionary defined arms as military equipment, and that congressional regulation of guns simply wasn't an issue. What had people worried, says Dellinger, was Article 1 of the Constitution,
which gave to the new district national government the authority to provide for the arming and maintaining of state militias. That's what was shocking and caused the movement of the Second Amendment and the discussion about the Second Amendment. All of those discussions are about the militias.
Lawyer Alan Gura, representing gun rights advocates, counters with a different historical view, pointing out that prior to the Revolution, the English king had tried to disarm the colonists.
They were quite upset about that. It was well understood that there was a right in English law to keep private arms for self-defense, for the defense of one's home and one's family, and this right was violated, and the Americans wanted to protect them.
Parsing the Second Amendment, Gura says arms means any weapon of self-defense, and keep means keep as an individual.
Says the right of the people to keep and bear arms, the shall not be infringed. That simply means the right of the people, you and I, just like the right of the people in the First Amendment.
Walter Dellinger replies that this interpretation simply reads out half the words in the amendment.
A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state is the context in which the people get to keep and bear arms.
He adds that the Second Amendment left regulation of private gun ownership up to the state so that they could decide for themselves whether they wanted it for the militia or whether it was better to store militia weapons in strategically placed depots. Dellinger maintains that the district has struck a reasonable balance on guns.
It permits people to have a whole house full of rifles and shotguns, prohibits the use of concealable handguns that can be taken in the subway to the schools, and is adopted by the District of Columbia, which has national security responsibilities.
That version of the law is simply nonsense, says gun rights advocate Alan Gura. Not only are trigger locks and unloaded guns unusable in an emergency, but the district's argument is akin to contending that the First Amendment allows certain books to be banned because other books are available.
The fact is that if something is protected by the Constitution, it is not up to a legislative majority to ban it.
The Bush administration has enraged gun rights advocates by trying to divide the baby, as it were, in this case. Breaking with the position taken for decades by the Justice Department, the Bush Justice Department has said there is an individual right to bear arms. But the Justice Department also argues that reasonable restrictions of that right are permitted to protect public safety, restrictions far more severe than those advocated by gun rights supporters. Indeed, in a brief cleared by the White House, the Justice Department contends that if the standard advocated by Mr. Gura in this case were to prevail, it would cast a cloud of doubt over existing federal laws banning machine guns and assault weapons. Today's case has aroused so much interest and controversy that 67 friend of the court briefs have been filed. Perhaps the most high profile of these is a brief siding with gun rights advocates and signed by a majority of the members of the House and Senate. Also signing that brief and disagreeing with the position taken by the Bush administration is Vice President Dick Cheney, acting, he says, not in his role as part of the executive branch, but as President of the Senate. Administration sources say Cheney did not advise the White House Counsel's Office or the Justice Department before signing the brief. The White House Press Office refused to say whether Cheney advised the President in advance. In any event, the last word will belong to the justices. Nina Tuttenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Well, that description by Nina Tuttenberg pretty well sets up the arguments for the case. I guess the key point there, I suppose, you should get, there's some odd things about this, but one interpretation is what Washington, D.C., and the former Solicitor General has said in his argument defending the D.C. gun law. He's saying that the militia and the arms that they're talking about in the Second Amendment really refer to arms only carried by the soldiers, in other words, the militia of that state. And that states should have the right to form militias, and they should have the right to establish arms or give arms, and people should be able to have arms to serve in that militia, and that it didn't refer to individual gun owner rights, such as things like pistols, for example, which were in existence at the time of the founding of our country. And one of the concerns about the regulation, you'll hear that when we hear the case, and I better get to it, is they had storage laws in colonial times where you couldn't keep the gun and the ammunition in the same spot. And one of the reasons was you had to keep the ammunition upstairs or vice versa and the gun downstairs because of the powder. The powder would get near the gun, or, you know, you'd have explosions and that type of thing. So there's concern over home safety, but it's kind of interesting. I remember once when I was doing my gun show study in Texas along with Tammy Kimball that we had, I had seen a little car driving around Plano, Texas a couple of times, and this woman had her baby in the car all the time. Instead of seeing those little signs that you see in the 1990s where baby on board, she had a little sticker on the back of her car that said, "Happiness is a warm machine gun." And machine guns come up several times in the argument in the court. So I'm going to turn on the court case right now. Again, it's long. It's about an hour and a half, so I don't want to play the whole thing. I'm going to play part of it, then I'm going to go to the end where they allow the rebuttal, the final statement to come up by former Solicitor Jenner Geller. And there's the line in there where they crack up the whole court. So here we go with the D.C. gun case, Washington, D.C. versus Heller. And it's a critical case, the most important one in about 60 or 70 years. So listen up.
We will hear argument today in case 07290, District of Columbia versus Heller. Mr. Dellinger.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. The Second Amendment was a direct response to concern over Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, which gave the new National Congress the surprising, perhaps even the shocking power to organize, arm, and presumably disarm the state militias. What is at issue this morning is the scope and nature of the individual right protected by the resulting amendment. And the first text to consider is the phrase protecting a right to keep and bear arms. In the debates over the Second Amendment, every person who used the phrase bear arms used it to refer to the use of arms in connection with militia service. And when Madison introduced the amendment in the first Congress, he exactly equated the phrase bearing arms with, quote, rendering military service. We know this from the inclusion in his draft of a clause exempting those with religious scruples. His clause says, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, a well-armed and well-regulated militia being the best security of a free country, but no person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms shall be compelled to render military service in person. And even if the language of keeping and bearing arms were ambiguous, the amendment's first clause confirms that the right is militia-related. It's a single meaning.
If you're right, Mr. Dellinger, it's certainly an odd way in the Second Amendment to phrase the operative provision. If it is limited to state militias, why would they say the right of the people? In other words, why wouldn't they say state militias have the right to keep arms?
Mr. Chief Justice, I believe that the phrase the people and the phrase the militia were really in sync with each other. You will see references in the debate of the Federalist Farmer uses the phrase the people are the militia,
That's right. Doesn't that cut against you if the militia included all the people? Doesn't the preamble that you rely on not really restrict the right much at all? It includes all the people?
Yes, I do believe it includes all the people in the sense of Verdugo and Quidez, all those who are part of the polity. What defines the amendment is the scope and nature of the right that the people have. It is a right to participate in the common defense, and you have a right invocable in court if a federal regulation interferes with your right to train for or whatever the militia has established. So that
that is the concern, Mr. Dellinger, of the framers, was not to establish a practice of amending the Constitution and its important provisions. And it seems to me that the interpretation of the Second Amendment, differing from that of the district court and in Miller, and not advanced particularly in the red brief, but that
conforms the two clauses and, in effect, de-links them. The first clause, I submit, can be read consistently with the purpose I've indicated of simply reaffirming the existence and the importance of the militia clauses. Those were very important clauses, as you've indicated there in Article 1 and Article 2. And so, in effect, the amendment says we reaffirm the right to have a militia. We've established it. But in addition, there is a right to bear arms.
I wanted to mention here about the protocol of the court. The lawyers make their arguments, and the justices are allowed to interrupt them at any time they want and ask questions. So what you're hearing here are various Supreme Court justices offering up their questions. And if you listen to this, you criminal justice professors want to use it in class. If you listen to this on oyez.org, oyez.org, you'll actually see the picture. You can show the picture of the person speaking and see the transcript scroll down as you hear the audio. So we'll continue.
You comment on that.
Yes.
This makes them, I think they're quite right in the brief to say that the preface shouldn't be extraneous. It just means it's not extraneous. The Constitution reaffirms several principles, the right of the people to peacefully assemble, the right to be secure in their homes, the Tenth Amendment reaffirms that. And this is simply a reaffirmation of the militia clause.
Justice Kennedy, I think any interpretation that relates the two clauses as if they were dealing with related but nonetheless different subject matters has that to count against it. And what you don't see in the debate over the Second Amendment are references to, in those debates, of the use of weapons for personal purposes. What you see is a clause that literally transposes to this because a well-regulated militia is necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep in their arms shall not be.
Well, the subject is arms in both clauses, as I suggested, that the common subject, and they're closely related.
I think, as this court unanimously held in Miller, or at least noted in Miller, I'll leave aside the debate of the court unanimously said in Miller, that the Second Amendment must be interpreted in light of its obvious purpose to ensure the continuation and render possible the effectiveness of the military force.
I don't think how there's any contradiction between reading the second clause as a personal guarantee and reading the first one as assuring the existence of a militia, not necessarily a state-managed militia, because the militia that resisted the British was not state-managed. But why isn't it perfectly plausible, indeed reasonable, to assume that since the framers knew that the way militias were destroyed by tyrants in the past was not by passing a law against militias, but by taking away the people's weapons, that was the way militias were destroyed. The two clauses go together beautifully. Since we need a militia, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be free.
Yes, but once you assume that the clause is designed to protect the militia, surely it's the militia that decides whether personal possession is necessary. The Miller, what makes no sense is for Miller to require the arm to be militia-related if the right is not. And the key phrase is bear arms.
Do you think the clause is the second clause, the operative clause, is related to something other than the militia?
No. I think the second clause, the phrase keep and bear arms, When bear arms is referred to in a military context. That is, so that even if you left the side,
it has nothing to do with the concern of the remote settler to defend himself and his family against hostile Indian tribes and outlaws, wolves and bears and grizzlies and things like that.
That is not the discourse that is part of the Second Amendment. And when you read the debate, the congressional debate, the only use of the phrase keep and bear arms is a military phrase.
Blackstone thought it was important. He thought the right of self-defense was inherent, and the framers were devoted to Blackstone. Joseph Storing, the first commentator on the Constitution and a member of this court, thought it was a personal guarantee.
But when Blackstone speaks of the personal guarantee,
describes it as one of the use of weapons, a common law right. And if we're constitutionalizing the Wrightsonian common law right, he speaks of a right that is subject to due restrictions and applies to, quote, such weapons, such as are allowed by law. So Blackstone builds in the kind of reasonableness of the regulation that the District of Columbia has. Now, that may be true, but that concedes your main point that there is an individual right and gets to the separate question of whether the regulations at issue here are reasonable. I don't dispute, Mr. Chief Justice, that the Second Amendment is positive law that a litigant can invoke in court. If a state were to decide after recent events that it couldn't rely upon the federal government in natural disasters and wanted to have a state-only militia and wanted to have everybody trained in the use of a weapon, a federal law that interferes with that would be a law that could be challenged in court by an individual. I mean, I think
the short of that, just to get your position clear, short of reactivating state militias, on your reading, does the Second Amendment have any effect today as a restraint on legislation?
It would, Justice Ginsburg, if the state had a militia and had attributes of the militia contrary to a federal law, and if it didn't...
But it doesn't. As far as I know
today, it doesn't, but I'm not... And the respondents make that argument that the amendment is without a use, but you don't make up a new use for an amendment whose prohibitions aren't being violated.
Your argument is that its purpose was to prevent the disarming of the organized militia. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And if that was the purpose, then how could the framers of the Second Amendment have thought that it would achieve that purpose? Because Congress has virtual plenary power over the militia under the militia clauses.
That is because I think, Justice Alito, that those who wanted to retake state authority over the militia didn't get everything they wanted. Madison actually did this somewhat reluctantly and wanted to maintain national control.
They got nothing at all. Not everything they wanted. They got nothing at all. So long as it was up to the federal government to regulate the militia and to assure that they were armed, the federal government could disband the state militias.
Yes, but if... Well,
so what was the function served by the Second Amendment as far as the militia is concerned?
It is by no means clear that the federal government could abolish the state militia. It may be presupposed by the Article 1, Section 8, Clauses 15 and 16, and by the Second Amendment that the states may have a militia. That issue has been left open as to whether you could do that, and it can be called into federal service, but only in particular circumstances. Now, I think the better argument for the other side, if there is to be a militia relatedness aspect of the Second Amendment, as we think clear from all of its terms, then Heller's proposed use of a handgun has no connection of any kind to the preservation or efficiency of a militia, and therefore the case is over. Now, but your reading of the militia clause specifically reserves certain rights to the state by its terms. And as I understand your reading, you would be saying the Second Amendment was designed to take away or expand upon the rights that are reserved rather than simply guaranteeing what rights are understood to be implicit in the Constitution itself. I'm not sure I followed the question exactly, but...
Well, the militia clause in Article 1, right. Section 8 says certain rights are reserved to the states with respect to the militia. And yet you're telling us now that this was a very important right that ensured that they kept arms, but it wasn't listed in the rights that were reserved in the militia clause.
The debate over the militia clause, what is shocking about the militia clause is that this is a new national government that for the first time has the power to create a standing army of professionals. The militia were people who came from the people themselves, put down their weapons of trade. The states were devoted to the idea of their militia of volunteers. And of all the powers granted to the federal government, one of the most surprising was to say that Congress shall have the power to organize, arm, and discipline the militia. And to, even though the officers could be appointed by the state, the discipline had to be according to Congress. And this caused a tremendous negative reaction to the proposed Constitution.
The Second Amendment doesn't repeal that. You don't take the position that Congress no longer has the power to organize, arm, and discipline the militia.
Now, you what?
So it was supplemented. And my question is, that the question before us is, how and to what extent did it supplement it? And if I...
think as you listen more to Mr. Dillinger's argument before the court and the justices' questioning, you're going to see that it looks like, if you could give some assessment to it, I think what I'm going to do, this is interesting enough and certainly important enough that I'm going to deal with this next week where we get to hear more of the arguments. But what I wanted to do tonight was jump ahead. We haven't heard the side on the side of Mr. Heller. Mr. Heller was a security guard in Washington, D.C. He carried a firearm during his duty as a security officer, but he had to lock it up in a locked facility before he left work because he wasn't permitted to take it home. And although many people wanted to join in on this case, they decided to take Mr. Heller's case since it almost perfectly fit the circumstances that gun rights advocates wanted portrayed in the court. I'm going to jump ahead and listen to Mr. Dillinger's final statements. It's about an hour and 27 minutes into the case. So if you bear with me here just a second, we'll find that particular location and play it.
Enforced by courts, they're going to limit those policies. And when you have a ban which bans 40% of all weapons that are the type of weapons used by civilians,
this is the Heller attorney finishing up here. So we'll go ahead to Mr. Dillinger again.
80% of all self-defense occurs with handguns. When you have that kind of ban, functional firearms ban. These are extreme to the Constitution's practice.
But just to be clear, I don't want to misstate your position. My understanding, or I at least inferred, you would consider it reasonable to ban shipment of machine guns and thought-of shotguns in interstate commerce?
Yes, Your Honor. And how about the state university wants to ban students having arms in the dormitory?
Certainly that creates some sort of an evidentiary record. Conceivably,
that's the bare fact. That's the one that... The state regulation prohibits students from having arms on campus.
We would have to
think
some fact-finding. It's something that might be doable, but again, that's so far from what we have here. We have here a ban on all guns for all people in all homes at all times in the nation's capital. That's quite simply too broad and too sweeping under any level of...
Thank you, Mr. Dura. Mr. Dillinger, 10 minutes.
Mr. Chief Justice, I want to address, first, why this law is reasonable and should be sustained and why the judgment below has to be reversed. However, whatever position you take on the theories of the amendment, and in defending the eminent reasonableness and careful balance of this law, I need to start with the trigger law, not with Justice Alito Act.
Well, before you start... How many minutes does it take to remove a trigger lock and load a gun? Because both of those, the gun has to be unloaded, it has to have...
This one is very good. Listen up.
Trigger lock under the district law.
Those are alternatives, Mr. Chief Justice.
Well, it's assembly between
district lock and unlock.
In either case, it has to be unloaded, correct?
There are some versions of the trigger lock that allow you to put the trigger lock on and then load the gun. The piece that goes in the trigger mechanism... Even someone as clumsy as I could remove it in a second.
Well, but the law, as I understand it, says that the gun has to be unloaded. So under your hypothetical, I assume that would violate the district's law if the gun is still loaded.
It's a question of where you put the parentheses. I read that as disassembled and unloaded or under a trigger lock.
And that's the way that...
So how long does it take, if your interpretation is correct, how long does it take to remove the trigger lock and make the gun operable?
You place the trigger lock on, and it has the version I have, a few that you can buy them at the 17th Street Hardware, has a code, like a three-digit code. You turn to the code, and you pull it apart. That's all it takes. Even someone, it took me 3 seconds.
Next to your bed, so you can turn the knob and 322.99.
So somebody, well, is it like that? Is it a numerical code?
Yeah, you don't have one with
so then you turn on the lamp, you pick up your reading glasses.
Let me tell you why. At the end of the day, this doesn't matter. For two reasons. The less
it may not matter, but I'd like some idea about how long it
takes. It took me 3 seconds. I'm not kidding. It's not that difficult to do it. That was in daylight. The other version is just a loop that goes through the chamber with a simple key. You have the key and put it together. Now, of course, if you want to have your weapon loaded and assembled, that's a different matter. But here's where I want to address the trigger lock. Here's why it doesn't matter for the handgun lock. The district believes that what is important here is the ban on handguns. And it also believes that you're entitled to have a functional, usable weapon for self-defense in the home, and that's why this is a very proportionate law.
Well, it's disproportionate. In other words, you're saying your interest is allowing self-defense in the home.
Yes.
Does it really make sense to say that that's
self-rifle or a shotgun
or a pistol?
There has been no showing here that a rifle or a shotgun is inadequate for the purposes of self-defense in this racial challenge.
Is there anything to show that the district council ever considered the issue of self-defense? Because they ban handguns, and they have this provision on the trigger lock, my question with the trigger lock doesn't have to do with whether trigger locks are generally a good idea. It's whether you're ever allowed to take it off for purposes of defense. Is there anything to show that the council actually considered what sort of weapon is appropriate for self-defense?
There are decisions in the District of Columbia about the right of self-defense that apply to this. But here's the most important point. It cannot affect the validity of the handgun law. If you disagree with us that my statements are not sufficient to say that we believe that the law should be read, given the self-defense compulsion, to allow whatever use makes it functional. If you don't agree with that, and if you think there's a controversy on this point, because we believe you should have a functional firearm available in the home of law-abiding citizens who wish one. If we're wrong about that and the trigger lock is invalid, that has no effect on the handgun ban. That's to say, the trigger lock applies to all weapons. If it's valid and it means what they say it does, none of the weapons would work. They don't need a handgun. It's unusable. If it's invalid, or if it has the construction we believe, it cannot possibly affect the handgun law. If you strike down the trigger lock law, you're throwing us in the briar patch where we think we're happy to be. If all we have to do is to make clear in the trigger lock law what we have said here today, that it's available for self-defense.
I think as you listen to this case, you're getting the idea, and we've jumped around here a little bit, but that's necessary given the length of the oral testimony before the U.S. Supreme Court. But if you listen to this case, one of the interesting issues there is they're not even sure, relative to the D.C. gun law, that when somebody does break into your home and you're abiding by the law by having trigger locks on on these rifle or a shotgun, if it's even legal to take the lock off and defend yourself. Now that probably to me, if that would be the major interpretation, that borders on insanity. I mean, why in the world would we have a gun? Well, I guess you could have it just for the purposes of going out and hunting and going to sport clubs and trap shooting and things like that. But people, I think, in D.C., a substantial portion of them would want those firearms to defend themselves. It's also interesting to note that as the D.C. gun law was going into effect, violent crimes and firearms crimes were going up in D.C. They eventually went down a little bit, and then up again. But in other parts of the country, these firearms offenses were going down substantially. And again, New York City is the best example, killing almost 2,200 in 1991-92 and dropping down to less than 500 last year. Well, Audrey's giving me the signal, folks, that it's time to sign off tonight. So I think we're going to have to take off for this evening. And we'll organize this in a format next week where you get the gist of this, and we'll hear the entire argument. And those of you who are criminal justice instructors that want to play this for a class, remember it's www.oyez.org, and you can not only hear the case, but you can see the transcript roll right along with the picture of the person that's speaking at the time. So good night, folks. I'm sure we'll meet again, and look forward to seeing you next week.